supportive group of people. So the paper I'm going to present today is sort of a condensed version of research that I did for my master's dissertation in the Migration Studies program at Oxford. And it focuses on a case study of immigration detention center in the southeastern United States, in Georgia, called Stewart Detention Center. So I guess I will just sort of jump in. When Stewart Detention Center opened in 2006, it quickly became one of the largest detention centers in the country. It's managed by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The facility currently holds about 1,900 people. Non-citizen detainees are held there while they await the outcome of the legal proceedings that will determine whether they'll be able to stay in the country or whether they'll have to leave. This legal process is overseen by the Executive Office of Immigration Review, which is sort of the dedicated immigration court system within the Department of Justice in the U.S., and there's a dedicated immigration court at the detention facility. Although the facility is nominally managed by ICE, it's on a day-to-day basis operated by CoreCivic, which is a private prison contractor. Many of you may have known them. They rebranded recently. They used to be called Corrections Corporation, where they've been, I guess, based on more humanitarian name these days. In the years after it opened, Stewart became sort of notorious as a national example of a particularly harsh system of immigration detention in the U.S. From 2007 to 2018, 97% of the people that were detained there were issued removal orders, which contrasts with the national average of about 60% of people in immigration courts. And at the same time, the facility has gotten a lot of media attention for pretty deplorable conditions. Since May of 2017, four people have died at the facility in controversial and frankly pretty preventable circumstances. So I think these sort of conditions broach a broader question about immigration detention, exclusion, and the nature of legal and political order in the U.S. And so I sort of ask the question here, I think, how can a detention system like this be compatible with the established legal and political orders of the liberal state? And so I'm seeking to sort of answer this question through a case study of Stewart. And in answering this question, I developed a concept called litigation by attrition, which comes out of a term that was frequently used by the practitioners I interviewed and got to spend some time with when I did my fieldwork at the facility in January 2018. Litigation by attrition refers to a defined relationship between the legal process of removal and the carceral system of immigration detention. At Stewart, as at detention centers across the U.S., each detainee passes through a very defined legal process in which they're afforded certain legal rights. And at the same time, of course, they're physically detained, they're tightly controlled, they're faced with multiple uncertainties, and they're constrained from access to legal and social assistance. They're also obviously in a facility that's managed by a private prison contractor. And as such, I would argue that the detainee is practically incapable of exercising their legal agency. So to understand this idea of capability, I draw on the work of Amartya Sen, who defines capability as the set of valuable functions that are available to an individual that that individual has access to. And so in this sense, I argue that Stewart operates not by sort of explicitly preventing detainees from taking certain actions, but by structuring the sort of range of available actions that are open to them. And I argue that this preserves the formal legal order of the liberal state while constraining the capability of detainees to sort of exercise their agency in practice. So, just to skip back a slide, this presentation will sort of be structured in a few parts. I think I was going to do a sort of brief overview of immigration detention since 1980 because I'm secretly a sort of closeted historian, but I think for the purposes of time, I'll skip back to that. If anybody is interested in that, we can sort of do that in the question and answer period, maybe. Then I will briefly outline what I call the detention system, which refers to the juxtaposition of the legal process of deportation against the day-to-day sort of business of detention itself. And then finish off, I'll talk about sort of what I see as the three primary ways that the legal capability of detainees are restricted at Stewart. So the shape and scale of immigration detention has grown quite sort of unrecognizably different since the first immigration detention center was built in the U.S. in 1891. Yet despite these changes, the explicit purpose of detention still ostensibly revolves around the sort of legal process of removability. U.S. Supreme Court in 2001, in the Zedvitas case, said very clearly that the function of detention is to restrain an individual while the legal system can determine whether she is subject to removal from the country or not. The apprehension, detention, and removal of individuals pursuant to violations of immigration law is governed and regulated under the Immigration and Nationalities Act. But unlike the system of criminal punishment, the INA defines immigration detention as civil detention, which has a series of implications for the rights of detainees. So although civil detainees don't have access to the constitutional protections that are associated with criminal punishment, i.e. they don't have certain rights around evidence in court, they also, I think, perhaps more importantly, don't get access to publicly funded legal representation or counsel, they do possess a very broad range of legal rights. Supreme Court has repeatedly confirmed that due process protections apply to individuals in immigration detention regardless of their citizenship or national origin. The Lanza v. Ashcroft decision in 2004 affirmed that aliens who have entered the United States, whether legally or illegally, cannot be expelled without the government following established procedures consistent with the requirements of due process. So I think we can see that detainees clearly possess a defined set of legal rights that constitutes the circumstances of their detention, and the state, at least nominally, can't simply apprehend and deport people at will. Yet in practice, 90% of the detainees in Stewart, or nearly 90% of the detainees, don't have legal counsel, and 97% of them were deported basically from 2007 to 2018. So I think this suggests that the efficiency of Stewart Immigration Court is not caused by the sort of simple suspension of legal order, but that there's actually a sort of more complicated process at work here. So I argue that to understand how the detention system affects the legal process of removal, you really need to understand how the two organizations here, i.e. CoreCivic, or I suppose you could say the three organizations, CoreCivic, ICE, and the immigration court system, how their sort of interests and their actions interact and sort of conflict and complement one another. ICE, obviously, is an enforcement agency. Their goal, very clearly, is to deport people and to deter future sort of irregular migrants from entering the country. As a private corporation, CoreCivic's goal is to maximize the profitability of detention. And I think sort of nominally these goals seem very separate or very different, but actually at Stewart they come to sort of overlap and reinforce each other in very interesting ways. Under a contractual arrangement, which is called an intergovernmental service agreement, which was signed between ICE, CoreCivic, and Stewart County, which is the local government, in 2006. ICE contracts with CoreCivic to provide beds for 1,900 detainees at the facility. But CoreCivic doesn't actually own Stewart, the sort of physical facility itself. It only leases it from Stewart County, who, interestingly, I think, originally built it as a men's medium security criminal prison in 2004, but couldn't basically fill it with enough people, so they leased it to CoreCivic to sort of keep the facility up and running. ICE pays Stewart County $62 per detainee per day. Stewart County retains less than a dollar of that per diem fee and pushes the rest of that money to CoreCivic. The contract, the way that it's structured, really incentivizes ICE to hold as many people at Stewart as possible. It stipulates a guaranteed minimum, which basically says that ICE pays for 1,600 detainees at the facility per day, whether or not those people are actually, there are actually that many detainees there. And for CoreCivic, Stewart is a pretty immensely profitable enterprise, and it generated roughly $38 million in revenue from Stewart in 2017, compared to much, much less significant revenue for the county over a similar time period. So what I think is sort of interesting about this is that this continuing profitability relies on maximizing revenue while minimizing the costs associated with the process of confinement. And one of the most disconcerting innovations of this contractual arrangement is the extent to which sort of cost-cutting comes to replace state discipline as the force through which internal hierarchies within the facility are established and enforced. And this logic of cost-cutting really informs basically every aspect of detained life. But I think one really good specific example of this is CoreCivic's voluntary work program. When each detainee is booked into the facility, they're automatically assigned to a work program, which may include kitchen duty, the barbershop, or just sort of doing basic repairs and cleaning around the facility. And although participation in the work program is supposedly not mandatory, this is really the only way that detainees can earn money to purchase goods that they need at the facility. And because CoreCivic, frankly, is not giving them adequate food or other sort of personal items like socks and underwear or food or certain hygiene products, this sort of voluntary work program is the only way that detainees can earn money to sort of support themselves through the sort of commissary at the facility. Detainees are generally paid between $1 to $3 a day, which is obviously significantly less than the national minimum wage of around $8 an hour. And what I think you see when you look at this work program is that this sort of low-cost, very captive workforce is used by CoreCivic to run many of the day-to-day operations of the facility, which ensures the overall profitability of Stewart as a sort of commercial enterprise, but also very much reinforces ICE's goals in terms of exclusion. So this sort of juxtaposition between the formal legal process of removal and the day-to-day business of detention is a critical feature of this process of litigation by attrition. To illustrate this, I'd like to highlight three primary sort of facets or mechanisms of power by which power operates to limit the capability of detainees to sort of resist this process of removal. The first is the remoteness of the detention system. The second is a time pressure akin to what Melanie Griffiths in her work on detention in the UK has called the temporal rupture of detention. And the last is a sort of dispersed accountability between ICE, CoreCivic, and the immigration court system. So first, just to sort of go through this idea of the remote geography of detention, in describing the experience of being detained at Stewart, a former detainee named Pedro Guzman writes that after 20 months away from my home, you lose faith, you feel worthless. Stewart is just made to break your soul and to handicap you. And I think Guzman's account points to the central importance of feelings of isolation to the ways that detainees experience Stewart. At Stewart, ICE and CoreCivic established very clear spatial orders to ensure the efficient administration of detention and removal. And so this remoteness is not a simple sort of measurement of physical distance, but rather remoteness results from a particular system of relations that locates the detainee inside of a detention system that is discursively positioned as distant and isolated from the outside world. And I think this actually connects to the wonderful presentation about prison transfers in the last session. One example of this that I think sort of illustrates this really well is the role played by transfers from criminal facilities to Stewart. Data from a recent Freedom of Information Act request suggests that from 2015 to 2018, transfers made up roughly 80% of the detainee population at Stewart, and 77% of those transfers originated from a facility that was outside of the state. Transfers to Stewart tend to come from sort of urban areas around the south. So the two largest sort of sources of transfers from out of state to Stewart were Mecklenburg County Jail, which is the sort of county jail in Charlotte, North Carolina, and the Alamance County Detention Facility, which is another county detention center, which is just outside of Charlotte. Transfers put detainees at obviously a significant legal disadvantage. It makes it harder for them to access legal representation and also just to gather the resources that they need to fight their cases, both in terms of sort of communicating with their family and also physically getting material together. And in personal terms, transfers distance detainees from their sort of social networks and their families. This isolation is compounded by the fact that detainees incredibly difficult to sort of communicate from inside the facility, outside the facility. Detainees have to pay exorbitant rates on phone calls to contact their families. One attorney that I spoke to told me that most of her clients who can afford to pay money to make phone calls spend upwards of $30 a week, which is quite a lot of money. And so I think this sort of gets to how this constructive remoteness really limits the capability of detainees. And I think the dislocating effects of Stewart's inaccessibility are compounded by these sort of conflicting time pressures. On one hand, the national immigration court system is so backlogged that immigration judges at Stewart are under significant pressure to move cases along really quickly. So as of March 2018, there are roughly 700,000 removal cases pending in immigration courts in the US nationally. But because detained dockets are much more easy to sort of move through the system than dockets in, non-detained dockets, detained dockets go much quicker. So the average detainee at Atlanta Immigration Court waits 682 days for their first master calendar hearing, whereas detainees at Stewart wait only 67 days. And obviously this sort of limited time has a big impact on the range of actions that are available to you in terms of finding a lawyer and trying to fight your case. There's one attorney that I interviewed said, many of the detainees are unsuccessful simply because the nature of how fast the detained docket is. And the speed of the court process contrasts with the sort of constant delays and periods of frustrated waiting that are experienced by detainees during their sort of time in the facility. Sharam Khosravi has written about how waiting in detention is an exercise of power used to manipulate other people's time. And attorneys and advocates are made to wait hours to visit their clients because there simply aren't enough core civic staff to bring people to the visitation centers. And one attorney I spoke to told me about a recent case involving an asylum seeker who had a very meritorious case, but simply couldn't be convinced to remain in detention for 3 months to wait for the result of his case, and so decided to accept deportation because he simply couldn't stick around. A sort of last feature, a last mechanism of power, I suppose, is what I call sort of the dispersion of accountability or the vanishing of accountability. Privatized detention has become the norm in the US since 2003. And among the attorneys and advocates that I talked to, privatization was most meaningful because it reduced the oversight of detention facilities and put political distance between the federal government and the humanitarian abuses that regularly occur in privately managed detention facilities. This displacement of responsibility is built into the system of contracting, the IDSA agreement. IDSA facilities are exempted from certain national detention standards, and during the most recent audit of Stewart, 188 of the 889 components of the performance-based national detention standards, which are the sort of the ICE's internal standards that are used to regulate detention facilities, were exempted. So they don't have to meet 188 of these components. And these components are critical features of the detention system. They include medical care, access to legal service, and so these exemptions mean that sort of when medical care, access to legal services, and protections against physical and sexual assault are inadequate, no one is held accountable. Boundaries between ICE and CoreCivic also really govern who has access to particular resources. This includes medical care. One asylum seeker who broke his leg at the facility wasn't seen for a month, and then when he was seen, when he eventually did get an x-ray, he wasn't able to communicate because the interpreter that they provided him didn't speak his actual language. And he remarked in an interview to the NGO Project South that, "I cannot understand the rules. I do not know how to make a complaint or file a grievance. I just want to get out of this place." And so I think by transferring the day-to-day business of detention to CoreCivic, the traditional forms of accountability associated with public administration have vanished. For detainees, this means that they're often shuttled between agencies who deny responsibility, and in these conditions, power is dislocated from authority, creating a system where domination is ambient but extremely difficult to locate and challenge. So I guess sort of to sort of conclude, I suppose, by taking a ground-level view of the detention system, the concept of litigation by attrition, I think, illuminates how power works to deprive detainees of their sort of practical capability to exercise meaningful legal agency while also maintaining the sort of order of the liberal state. Isolated from the outside world, the remote geographies of detention prevent detainees from accessing their networks of social and legal support, while this sort of drive for speedy administration conflicts with the constant waiting and uncertainty of detention, producing a temporal rupture that prevents many detainees from being able to stick around and see the legal process through. And as the accountability associated with public administration has effectively vanished under privatization, power has basically been dislocated from authority, which creates a system where domination, again, is ambient, but extremely difficult to sort of find and hold to account. And altogether, I think this demonstrates how this sort of detention system preserves the formal legal order of the liberal state while effectively restraining the capability of detainees to exercise meaningful agency in practice. And that's it. Thank you very much.